So, I'm going to start today's talk on the Apelian with Christopher Marlowe's introduction to a digression. I'm thinking of a digression in his hero in Leander, a short mythological narrative poem about two young lovers. According to the myth, Hero and Leander lived on opposite sides of the Hellespont. Leander swam each night to find his hero until one wintry, stormy night, when, buffeted on all sides by the gathering billows, he met a tragic death, and the lovely hero killed herself. This, at least, is how the story is told in most sources, including the Hero and Leander by Musaeus the Grammarian, which is a short poem in Greek hexameters composed in 5th century imperial Egypt. Cupid, writes Musaeus, could not stay the fates. But this is not the outcome in Marlowe's poem, which was printed in 1598, some 5 years after his death, with the words, De sunt nonnulla, i.e. unfinished, inscribed below it. Marlowe's narrative ends with the morning after the couple's first night together, or rather, the moment just before the morning after. Hero, embarrassed after losing her virginity, tries to slink out of bed to avoid looking at Leander. Trying to snatch her back to him, Leander pulls instead the sheet from around her, and she is left standing naked and blushing in what Marlowe describes as a rosy, false morn that irradiates the room just before the forces of the universe are preparing to usher in the day. The poem stops here, before the outside world has time to encroach on the lovers, and long before their mythical fate destroys them. Marlowe does get to say something about the fates, however, earlier in the digression that I have already mentioned. Musaeus' verse, Cupid could not stay the fates, seems to have caught his imagination, for he playfully turns it into an event. When Marlowe's Cupid wounds Hero, he's so gripped by remorse that he visits the Destinies and made request both might enjoy each other and be blessed. The Destinies answer Cupid's request, not in words, but with a withering look. Marlowe goes into a labyrinthine mythological diversion at this point to explain why the Destinies hated Cupid. And when he emerges back onto the narrative, he recaps, then muse not, Cupid sued, no better spared. But what does no better mean? To interpret the Destiny's scowl as a prophecy of the ending we know from other sources is to admit into the poem something Marlowe takes pains to leave out of it. Marlowe is making the reader alone guilty of any thought of that fatal ending. If we are, moreover, reading his poem as readers of epic, we're doubly guilty. For in epic, two-part wishes like Cupid's might enjoy each other and be blessed have a bad history. When in the Iliad, Achilles prays to Zeus that Patroclus may win glory and come back safe, one part the father granted him and the other denied. And when Arruns in the Aeneid prays that he may kill Camilla and return home even unpraised, Phoebus granted half the prayer but half upon the passing breeze he threw. If Cupid's carefully constructed two-part request is meant to prompt our epic memory, then Marlowe is involving the reader in the challenge of telling this story differently. If this is a silent allusion that works through the poem's affiliation with epic, then this generic affiliation is being put to use in a very pointed way. The matrix of epic activates the threat of death even as the poem itself manages to escape it and remain innocent of anything but the giddy drama of youthful desire. It matters a great deal then for how we read the poem, what genre we're in, and what kind of conversations with epic are within this poem's horizon of expectations, as Hans Robert Jaus puts it in his discussion of genre. This is not, I believe, the only time that Marlowe's poem looks to epic, and to Homer's and Virgil's epics in particular, and gathers special meanings from that relation, and therefore by assuming in the reader an active consciousness of epic. Yet the way in which we're accustomed to approaching the genre of Hero and Leander is somewhat different from this. Marlowe's poem is an important member of what has become a relatively fixed canon of poems known to critics as the Ovidian Apelia of the 1590s. To anyone not familiar with this English tradition, the term will seem a little strange, since for all the doubtful things about the classical Apelian, classicists would agree on one thing: Ovid did not write one. English critics, in fact, owe the term to a particular moment of comparative criticism. This 1590s canon properly starts with Marlowe's Hero and Leander and Shakespeare's Venus and Adonis, both composed in 1593, and expands into a range of poems on mythological subjects taken from Ovid's Metamorphoses, all the way down to the 1602 Salmasis and Hermaphroditus. The Ovidian label attaches itself to Hero and Leander because Ovid treats the story not in the Metamorphoses, but in the Heroides. The canon was proposed as early as 1958, by Paul W. Miller. The family resemblances between these poems had, however, been established earlier, and indeed Miller attempted to shed new light on what he says it had become customary to refer to as Ovidian poems. He was proposing to call these Ovidian works epilia, influenced by a new paradigm from classical studies. The paradigm was that of Marjorie Crump, who argued more extensively than anyone before that the classical epilion was a distinct poetic genre invented by the Alexandrians and continued by the Romans. She defined it as a short narrative poem, though of variable length, concerned most commonly with a love story. Epilia were sometimes decorated with descriptive passages and frequently employed the dramatic form. But nothing characterized the genre more than the digression, which could overshadow the frame tale. Crumb's instances included some of Theocritus' idylls, fragmentary poetry like Callimachus' Acalli, and Roman examples like Catullus' 64 and the Pseudo-Ovidian Chiris. But she also argued that the epilion influenced other genres like Virgil's Georgics 4 and Ovid's Metamorphoses as a whole. It is easy to see why Miller found a compelling parallel here for the Elizabethan mythological narratives, which all display some of these features at the same time as fulfilling the length criterion. His proof was taxonomical rather than historical, using Hero and Leander as the Elizabethan example par excellence, with its dramatic speeches and above all its startling digression. He showed that we're dealing here with exactly the same kind of poem. Now, the oddest aspect of Miller's argument may seem to us to be his reluctance to relate this epilic exemplarity of Marlowe's poem to the fact that it is the only one in the 1590s group to be based on a short mythological narrative poem from antiquity, that of Musaeus. Indeed, Miller refers to Musaeus' work not as an epilion or even as a poetic model, but as a touching 5th century story. The reason for this must lie with the notion of antiquity that underlies Crump's argument, which stops sometime before the 5th century. For her, the classical epilion dies with Ovid's absorption of it in his epic. In this way, Crump also avoids the problem posed by three short narrative poems from late antiquity, which do not reflect the narrative aesthetics she considers constitutive of the genre. Musaeus' Hero and Leander, Callutus' Rape of Helen, and Trifiodorus' Sack of Troy, none of which features a digression. We have a strange situation here. A synergy between two literary critical traditions leads to a deeply unhelpful conclusion. Marlowe's poem revives the ancient epilion by being unlike the short narrative poem from antiquity that it draws on. The Elizabethan poet appears to be spontaneously epilionic. A less absurd answer to this problem would be to say that Marlowe finds a congruity between his source, Musaeus, and the type of poem and poetics that Crump taxonomizes. But this is to ask whether Marlowe has a notion of the classical epilion. And the question, I believe, has never really been asked in relation to the Elizabethan poems since Miller. And we have that same moment of comparative criticism to blame. Crump's confidence in the existence of such a genre was not shared by all classicists and was most vehemently denied by Walter Allen in 1940. Stressing that the epilion is not classical, Allen scrutinized Crump's defining criteria and examples and concluded that no two of these poems have any one characteristic in common unless it be some characteristic which is so general that it is shared by a large portion of ancient poetry. He was also quick to notice that other disciplines were in danger of infection by Crump's paradigm. Publishing the same journal and year as Miller, he hastened to correct the English scholar who had been led astray in a piece with a wonderfully self-explanatory title, The Non-Existent Classical Epilion. Here he declared, I know nothing of the English poems under discussion, but I fear that Mr. Miller has caught a tiger in his classical comparison. There never was such a literary genre as the Appian, and the name and the genre are errors on the part of comparatively recent classical philology. English scholars were not insensible to his admonition, yet unwilling to part entirely with the tiger, they decided to lock it up in a footnote. No study of the Elizabethan Appian has since then lacked the obligatory caveat that refers to Caveat's essay before virtually always going on to adopt the term for its conciseness, but also for the suggestion it carries of something more formally cohesive about this group of poems than the sum of their indisputable resemblances. These discussions have inevitably, and with good reason, been about the poems as Ovidian productions of the 1590s. But for all its richness, this critical tradition has effectively completely ignored Miller's suggestion that something other than Ovid might explicate or energize this group of poems. The discussion carried on as before, but for that caged tiger, the faulty generic designation, Appian. In the remaining 10 minutes, I propose that we take the tiger out for a little walk. I would like to ask Miller's question again. Did the short epics of antiquity have a role to play in shaping the poetry of the 1590s? Alan's speedy intervention snuffed out a dialogue between classics and English, which it seems valuable to renew. It's valuable firstly because discussions of the 1590s Appia are never in fact sealed off from the generic designation they adopt for the sake of convenience. Notions of the Appian are regularly smuggled into discussions of these poems without being calibrated against what recent classicists make of the genre and without questioning the currency of such notions for the early modern period. Another reason for revitalizing the question is that the Hoffman generic designation solders the link between these Ovidian poems, even as it isolates them from everything else. By everything else, I'm thinking specifically of a parallel repertory of narrative poems from the 1590s, which are not Ovidian in an obvious way. They include Richard Barnfield's spoof miniature epic Helen's Rape and his poem on the unlikely romance between Agamemnon and Cassandra. Other examples are John Trussell's The First Rape of Helen by Theseus, John Peel's The Tale of Troy, and Peter Coles's Penelope's Complaint. This parallel repertory makes it worth asking whether the canon of the Ovidian Appia we have come to consider a monolithic genre might in fact hold two separate elements in suspension, a form that in some way scales down epic, and a poetry with an Ovidian narratology and psychological comedy. Might these poems be responding to two separate models, and with generic effects slightly more varied than we have cared to notice? Could even Hero and Leander and Venus and Adonis, the poems Douglas Bush called the twin peaks of the Ovidian tradition in England, not in fact be so generically identical? And could Hero and Leander, to return to the question I began with, be affiliated to the matrix of epic in a way that differentiates it completely from Shakespeare's dialogue with Ovid in Venus and Adonis? Here we need to return to the short epics of antiquity. Classicists today would probably say that reports of the Appian's non-existence have been greatly exaggerated, and would probably think of late antiquity as the period that most flatly contradicts Alan. Whatever name Musaeus, Trifidorus, or Calluthus might have used, writing a short mythological poem in Homer's Idyll was a recognizable literary endeavor. Such poems work in conversation with epic, and the small scale that differentiates them from epic is part of the conversation. Now, these works were much more visible to early modern readers than they are to us. Their authors had yet to be assigned to that late phase of ancient literature, which is now a niche interest in classical scholarship. Musaeus was conflated with a mythical poet predating Homer, and his poem was among the most frequently printed and translated Greek texts in the 16th century, sometimes for the interest of its love story, and often as an educational text, as a primer in the Greek hexameter. The Appia of Calluthus and Trifidorus, on the other hand, were included from about 1570 onwards in virtually every edition of Homer's epics as supplements to his accounts of the Trojan War. Calluthus had a special visibility as the only source that recounts the rape of Helen, and was singled out in what was a fairly standard way of prefacing Homer by offering an orientation tour of the sources that recounted those parts of the story of Troy not covered by Homer. Some readers, like this one, even constructed their own map of such sources. So this is, someone has written, done this at the front of his Iliad, and takes you through all the sources on the Trojan War, and Calypso is up there. Two translators of the Iliad, meanwhile, Dusue from 1620 and Malipiero from 1640, began their versions with a compilation of the events leading up to the Iliad, including an extended paraphrase on Calypso in both cases. In such works, we sometimes find the works of Musaeus and Calypso referred to as poematia, a term very close to the forbidden Epilion. Both poems are appreciatively referred to, and with the word lepidissimum, charming, elegant, or fine, recurring in relation to them. As to their genre, the early modern approach is surprisingly liberating. In his important commentary on Aristotle's Poetics, Lodovico Castelvetro contests Aristotle's stricture that epic poems need to be long. To me, it does not seem necessary for epics to be always this long, and we have a laudable example of an epic which is short in length in Musaeus' Hera and Leander. Castelvetro goes on to propose that short epics had different conditions of performance, being recited in piazza, in the streets, to delight audiences for a few hours, rather than taking up the full 24 days that Castelvetro thinks would have been required to perform Homer's epics. Julius Caesar Scaliger, meanwhile, discussing the epic plot in his own Poetics, again looks to Hero and Leander as the instructive exception. Musaeus' subject matter, he says, necessitates a narration from beginning to end, rather than one that springs narrative surprises on the reader. For both these theorists of early modern poetics, these works are quite simply epics, except they're short ones. Mobilizing the same tradition, they're governed by the same rules and possess the same poetic resources as epic. They sample epic without aspiring to its full cultural status. The early modern attitude to the epics of late antiquity enables us, I think, to see different things in Marlowe's Epilion and to read it and the tradition it belongs to afresh. This is one thing we gain from letting the tiger loose. As the wild surmises of Castelvetro about the origins of Musaeus' poem show, the early modern period did not arrive at some essential understanding about the historical genre that classicists of the early 20th century somehow missed. Indeed, neither these poems nor the mock epic, another type of Epilion that was more visible then than it is now, are ever theorized together. But they all occupy a similar position alongside epic, in relation to epic, and as a preparation for it. And this position functions like a genre in what Genette would call the period's unconscious poetics. Without theorizing it, the early modern period turns a fragmentarily attested tendency across antiquity to do the epic in short, into a live literary practice. Crump observes different manifestations of the same tendency to arrive at an anatomy of literary history. While recent classes' objections to that literary history don't map onto the generic perceptions of the early modern period, they can help us get somewhat closer to them. Precisely because so little about the history of the Epilion in antiquity is known, its reception is an extreme test case for the challenges of moving across different critical traditions. How reflectively we do our comparative criticism can change entirely the object we're looking at.
This is going to be a dilettante-ish sort of paper. My background, as Stephen said, is in classics, well, mainly classics. But here I'm going to be sampling various fields of which many people in this room have much more expert knowledge than me. So let this stand as an apologia, but not necessarily as an apology, because in doing so I hope to interrogate the process by which classical antiquity became a discipline rather than a diversion, the domain of professional scholars instead of a casual amateur pastime. And I hope to do this by adopting the epistemological standpoint of the 18th century dilettante, for whom knowledge came not from solitary contemplation, but rather from a network of lateral interconnections. There are three principles which encapsulate the dilettante's approach to knowledge. These are empiricism, heterogeneity, and pleasure. Pleasure initially directs the gaze towards objects or subjects of desire, seducing the amateur into devoting his time to them with a view to developing a more intimate relationship. And there's no false romantic distinction here between delight in the beauty of an aspect and delight in accurate measurement. One reinforces the other. Witness the juxtaposition of lively illustration and schematic diagrams. This is from Richard Chandler's Ionian Antiquities from 1769, which I'll refer to a bit later on in more detail. Importantly then, the dilettante's pursuit of knowledge was not driven by economic imperatives. It consisted of what Richard Hibbert has called gratuitous activity. At this time, unfortunately, the prerogative of a social elite who could afford to concentrate on input rather than output and follow the intuitive threads of intellectual passion. Passion prompts participatory engagement, the impulse to try your hand at poetry or painting or digging or collecting. The dilettante may be distinguished in this respect from the connoisseur, whose role is that of a specialist consumer. Christian Jägermann described the dilettante as ein Liebhaber der Künste, der nicht allein betrachten und genießen, sondern auch an ihrer Ausübung teilnehmen will, a lover of the arts who does not only want to contemplate and enjoy them, but rather wants to take part in the practice. In terms of antiquarian enthusiasm, this manifested as empiricism. Noah Herringman has commented that within Enlightenment epistemology, it quotes, natural sciences and antiquarianism are intrinsically related as cognate sciences of antiquity, end quote, approached with the same systematic techniques of observation, classification, quantification. And nowhere is this more apparent than in the discourse surrounding Vesuvius and Pompeii, where geology and archaeology become inseparable. Similarly, Goethe comments in his Italian Journey that I cannot repeat often enough how much my hard-won knowledge of those natural things which man takes as his raw material and transforms to suit his needs helps me to get a clearer idea of the craftsman's technique. Just as my knowledge of mountains and the minerals extracted from them is of great advantage to me in my study of architecture, in der Kunst. This brings us to the aspect of dilettantism most relevant to the comparatist scholar, namely its inherent eclecticism. A dilettante's knowledge of antiquity was networked, meaningful only in conjunction with other bodies of knowledge, such as art history. It was also a highly personalized form of knowledge, accrued according to the mobile predilections of the individual, rather than channeled into predetermined categories. As Otto Ludwig would put it in 1891, dilettantismus verwischte die Grenzen, dilettantism blurs the boundaries. Recalling that it was, of course, Goethe who was responsible for announcing the dawning era of Weltliteratur in 1827, as we heard a lot about this morning, we might reassess in light of this his earlier engagement with dilettantism. In 1799, Goethe and Schiller put together the outline of the essay Über den Dilettantismus, in which Goethe represented the dilettante as a kind of apprentice, learning his favoured craft in private before exhibiting it in public. But this essay is confined to a discussion of artistic endeavour. To see where classical antiquity fits in, it's necessary to make a detour to Italy and consider some observations made by Goethe in his Italienische Reise, The Italian Journey. Now, dilettantes in Italy have a special relationship. Both the superficial cultivation of the grand tourist and the indiscriminate enthusiasm of the polymath display the essential characteristics of dilettantism outlined above. To northern Europeans, 18th century Italy provided a locus amoenus, pleasure, first-hand encounters with iconic classical sites and artifacts, empiricism, and a dazzling diversity of natural and cultural phenomena to be assimilated, heterogeneity. Goethe's Italian Journey displays all of these modes of interaction, particularly the latter and its affiliation with comparatism. Throughout his account, Goethe combines geological and ethnographical observations with comments on landscape, architecture, and personal development. Early on, he cheerfully self-identifies as a dilettante artist and an amateur numismatist, and makes regular apologies for his lack of knowledge, coupled with expressions of a fervent desire to learn about such disparate topics as naval matters, Seewesen, classical sculpture, and marine biology. He represents himself as beset by, as inundated by, a crowd of busy spirits who compete for the interest of man's inner self, drawing him this way and that, and confusing him by the variety of their divided appeals. This apparent chaos, however, not only entails a disciplined or perhaps cross-disciplined method of rearrangement, but also becomes cognitively beneficial. Confronted by his prolific data, Goethe writes that, "If I didn't see that there are ways of sorting out and comparing these hundreds of observations, despite their ostensible confusion, I should often think I was going mad." Comparison, he explains, enables the present and the past to attain mutual illumination, and reveals this as the intrinsic worth of works of art, which in isolation are valued only for their rarity. Finally, he turns his dilettantism into an intellectual asset, what he calls the fortunate gift of being able to think of many things and see their connections in a short time. And it's these lateral connections, I would argue, that constitute the basis of a dilettante or comparatist epistemology. In England, the term dilettante was recuperated by a group of individuals who became an institution, the Society of Dilettanti. We can trace the development of the society from its original structure of private patronage to the much more formal procedures and collective identity adopted by later versions of the committee. Originally a dining club whose sympotic activities led Horace Walpole to remark in 1743 that the nominal qualification for membership is having been in Italy and the real one being drunk, the society's first members were young male aristocrats recently returned from the Grand Tour and unwilling to give up the lifestyle. They were seriously committed to hedonism and almost as seriously committed to educating England in matters of aesthetic taste. And after a while, this latter vocation began to predominate. In 1749, two British artists resident in Italy, James Stewart and Nicholas Revett, received funding from some interested members of the society to undertake an exploratory trip to Athens, where they intended to sketch and record the architectural remains of classical Greece. Now, the novelty of this proposition cannot be overstated. While a handful of intrepid travellers had ventured across the Adriatic before, it was incredibly rare. The Grand Tour stopped at Venice. To northern Europeans, Greece was essentially a fantasy world populated by Arcadian shepherds and Turkish brigands. Knowledge of classical art was based almost exclusively on Italian collections, whose most prized pieces, the Belvedere Apollo, the Laocoon group, the Dying Gaul, the Medici Venus, etc., were not the product of classical, i.e. 5th century Greece at all, but much later Greco-Roman reproductions. We can debate production, reproduction, etc. They're not 5th century statues. Right? Even the greatest authorities on ancient art, such as Johann Joachim Winckelmann, had never personally set foot in Greece or seen any of its artifacts in situ. What Stewart and Revett accomplished was the transformation of Greece from a literary phenomenon into a live, material landscape. On their return in 1755, the Society of Dilettanti agreed to back the publication of their sketches, their notes, and architectural studies. And the first volume of Stewart and Revett's Antiquities of Athens was published in 1762 and inspired a whole new design movement, the Greek Revival. This is Stewart and Revett in Athens. Painted themselves in at the bottom of the picture. Up to this point, the Society's support for antiquarian investigation had been entirely ad hoc and reactive, privately funded by individual members. But the success of Antiquities of Athens led them to commission a further Greek expedition, this time to the Aegean coast of Turkey, the area known from ancient textual sources as Ionia. This is where this expedition went. Richard Chandler and his team were instructed to, quote, visit every place worthy of your notice within 8 and 10 days' journey of Smyrna, modern Izmir. Although primarily concerned to gather data on, quote, the several remains of antiquity in that neighbourhood, the dilettante's interest was not restricted to inscriptions, elevations, bas-reliefs and so on, but rather Chandler's brief stipulated that, quote, it is expected that you do report to us for the information of the society whatever can fall within the notice of curious and observing travellers. Evidently, the backers of this reconnaissance mission regarded ancient sites not as isolated relics, but as embedded in their surrounding environment. And the orientalizing impulse behind many of Chandler's depictions has, of course, been noted, for example, by Jason Kelly. But I want to draw attention to three other aspects. The eclecticism of Chandler's observations, the emphasis on first-hand and eyewitness experience, and the increasingly official involvement of the dilettanti in gathering and disseminating knowledge of ancient culture. Ionian Antiquities was published in 1769, Chandler's journals following a few years later. And this marked the society's most influential period in terms of directing the public consumption of antiquity. Their publications were a conduit for images of the ancient world that carried unprecedented authority. But attitudes towards the textual and material remains of classical antiquity were changing. Specialism and professionalism supplanted the gratuitous curiosity of the dilettante. In Germany, this transition resulted in the establishment of philologia as an independent academic discipline. In England, the dilettanti were thoroughly discredited when their spokesman Richard Payne Knight, opposing a panel of professional experts, expressed his contempt for the recently acquired Elgin marbles. In both cases, the reorganisation of knowledge had involved disentangling particular strands from previously networked information and isolating them for dedicated perusal. Now, philology, or textual emendation in this sense, had of course been going on for centuries, but in German universities around the turn of the 19th century, it became a science, and for some evangelical converts, such as Friedrich August Wolff, practically a religion. The aim of humanist education, Bildung, was supposedly to perfect the individual via the study of human culture. The study of culture was to proceed via the study of language, and as the most perfect language was supposed to be, surprise, surprise, ancient Greek, Greek textual criticism was promoted as a fast track to enlightenment. But as Anthony Grafton has shown, the ideology of philologia was unsustainable in practice. Grafton writes, quote, as each subdiscipline developed a technical literature of its own, student and teacher found it harder and harder to retain any vision of Greek or Roman culture as a whole. Or in other words, professors tended to lecture more and more about less and less. At the same time, universities were claiming a monopoly on qualified opinion. Anyone who belonged to what Suzanne Marchand terms the international culture of gentlemanly collectors could no longer rely on social status to confer legitimacy. And the most notorious example of this is Richard Payne Knight's defeat by the panel of professional sculptors consulted by the Select Committee on the Earl of Elgin's collection of sculptured marbles in 1816. Knight still regarded freestanding masterpieces like the Belvedere Apollo as the epitome of classical art and refused to accept that Elgin's primitive, dirty, overrated fragments could be genuine. The pediments at the top he dismissed as poor Roman reproductions, and the frieze at the bottom as merely architectural, probably by workmen scarcely ranked among artists, intended to produce an effect like that of the simplest monochromatic painting. Knight's derision provoked an outrage response in the press from artist Benjamin Hayden. And Hayden says, in no other profession is the opinion of the man who had studied it for his amusement preferred to that of him who has devoted his soul to excel in it. Why should a connoisseur of an art, more exclusively than any other without the reach of common acquirement, be preferred to the professional man? And the terms of Hayden's attack show exactly why the perspective of the dilettante, here conflated with the connoisseur or leisured consumer, could no longer be taken seriously. In any case, Knight made a comprehensive hash of his cross-examination by the parliamentary committee. He was assessing the marbles according to outdated aesthetic criteria, for example, the elimination of realistic muscular exertion. And in doing so, he was adhering to a superseded phase of Philhellenism. During the heyday of the dilettanti, classical sculpture belonged within an integrated system of cultural discourses that supported its evaluation as decorative artwork, what Knight tactlessly referred to in his critique as furniture. Now the Elgin marbles and other ancient artifacts were instead prized as a resource for historical investigation, regardless of their alignment or otherwise with contemporary taste. Ironically, the very precision which the dilettanti had first promoted in their expeditions to Greece was now their undoing. Knowledge was fast becoming the prerogative of the specialist. So dilettantism possessed some principles in common with comparative, or you could say, interdisciplinary studies. Now, this is not to suggest that we subscribe to the values of an 18th century gentleman's club, nor that specialism is to be forsaken. On the contrary, cultivating disinterested specialism is a vital function of the academy. Rather, by taking stock of what Louisa Carle and Adriana Crashion have called this pre-disciplinary phase of knowledge production, allows us better to appreciate the contingency of our own present circumstances, intellectual, economic, and institutional. So perhaps then we may take a dilettante's approach to dilettantism and choose to reactivate those elements which most appeal to our appetites, our senses, and our curiosity. Thank you.
Yes. So I'm going to dance to, sorry, I'm going to talk today about... Well, that's the point of the paper, perhaps. That I'm going to talk today about the relationship between dance and literature as it is played out in the works of Pascal Quignard, and mainly his essay L'origine de la danse, published earlier on this year. I will seek to address several questions. How is dance construed and constructed as an ideal of embodied writing in this essay? And how are dance and literature seen as complementary? Or in other words, what can dance as a non-verbal, silent art form express what literature cannot? Writers, be they poets, novelists or philosophers, have nurtured a long-standing fascination for dance and the figure of the dancer. Théophile Gautier's muse was Carlotta Grisi, who embodied Giselle in the ballet he had written for the libretto, Louis Fuller inspired Stéphane Mallarmé to write his notes on ballet in Crayonné au théâtre. And La Argentina inspired Paul Avaleri with his platonic dialogue, La Méladance, just to limit ourselves to the Romantic and the Modernist period. More recently, philosophers like Jean-Luc Nancy have also turned to dance and the figure of the dancer to work out questions about their own craft, in particular how writing, thinking, and dancing exchange characteristics. His book Allitération, a dialogue with French choreographer Mathilde Meunier, has been for him the opportunity to reflect on more general questions about the relationship between body and mind, the subject's experience of space and time, his sense of self, and possibly altered states of consciousness, such as trance. So before I take these questions further, I would like to say a few words about Pascal Quignard and L'origine de la danse. Pascal Quignard was born in 1948 in the aftermath of World War II and in the midst of Reconstruction. He is a prolific and versatile author who started writing in the 70s, translating classic authors fallen into oblivion, like Lycophron, wrote successful novels and fiction in the 80s and 90s, in particular Tous les matins du monde, which gained him popularity with a larger readership when it was set to screen in 1991. And ever since, while pursuing his career as a fiction writer, he continues to write. He's continuing to write essays. Pascal Quignard is a Renaissance man of sorts in that sense. He is a practicing musician, an organist, and a gambist. And over the last decade, he has also written a number of librettos for opera and dance. L'origine de la danse is a reflection on his 2 years tour of Medea with Buteau dancer Carlotta Ikeda. From November 2010 to April 2013, both traveled around Japan, France, and Europe, from Tokyo to Le Havre, the show's end destination, and the very city where Quignard grew up after the war. It is a duo that brings together Quignard reading his own text, Medea, a loose rewriting of the Greek myth and Euripides and Seneca's versions of it, followed by a Buteau performance by Carlotta Ikeda. So L'origine de la danse is in fact an account of this experience. It is a hybrid text which integrates Medea the libretto. It contains autobiographical fragments relating his fraught relation, author's fraught relations with his mother, and it is a meditation on dance and Buteau dancing in particular. So what is Buteau dance? Because I didn't know again. So Buteau would translate as the dance of utter darkness. It is a Japanese art form that emerged in the late 50s, throwing off the constraints of Western dance and the codes of no theater. It wants to be subversive, and the founders, Hijikata and Ono, both claim influence from German expressionist dance, as well as from playwrights like Jean Genet and Artaud. But what interests Kinyarfer most in Buteau is that it is the expression of the cultural mourning of the Hiroshima bombing, which had been forbidden and silenced during the American occupation until 52. My paper will therefore show how dance is no longer a metaphor for writing. Broadly speaking, from the Romantic period with Novalis and Gautier to the Modernist period with Mallarmé and Valéry, dance was seen as a form of sublimation. It was seen as a practice embodying an ideal of grace and beauty. Based on athletic mastery, it was construed as an overcoming of our bodily condition. By contrast, Kinyarfer makes dance, in particular Buteau, a full endorsement of our bodily condition, a return to a silent, pre-linguistic mode of relating to the world. Kinyarfer defines dance as a return to what he calls the moment of birth, l'instant natal, the native moment, a rediscovering of the world as first experienced by a newly born. But Buteau is also a dance of reconstruction. L'origine de la danse partakes in a process of mourning, both personal and cultural. Kinyarfer's mourning of his painful relationship with his mother, but also of the ruins left by the bombing of Le Havre by the Allies, and the ashes of the anonymous mass murder of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So for that reason, I also want to look at how the practice of dancing is also construed as a consoling process. So contrary to what the video may suggest, dance and text are not simultaneously performed. Carlota Ikeda comes onto stage after Kinyarfer has finished reading his own text, Medea. Her dance, therefore, is not narrative or illustrative of the text. Instead, the Buteau performance appears to be a continuation of it, a response spelled out in movements to Kinyarfer's reading. It is a bodily translation of the violence of Medea's choice, the suffering she has been inflicted by Jason's betrayal, the suffering she inflicts on herself, her children, on her husband, by her vengeance. Kinyarfer's reading lasts no longer than 15 minutes, yet it has the same intensity as Ikeda's movements. His version of Medea is indeed pared down to the crucial moment of her dilemma, when she decides whether or not she will kill both her sons, Murmurous and Pheres. It is the moment when the pain of love betrayed transforms into hatred and vengeance that interests Kinyarfer. He renders the pain that underpins her hesitation and choice, and the way it mutates into an urge to kill, almost palpable. Medea becomes the very emblem of ambivalent maternal love. And Kinyarfer has a ponder over what appears to be beyond reason, namely that a mother, who uniquely possessed the power to bear life, has also the power to destroy it. Most strikingly, the text is overtly subversive when it amalgamates the figure of Medea with Maria standing at the foot of the cross, making her the offer of her son's sacrifice. And in the following sentence, Kinyarfer brings in unexpectedly the pronoun I, thus amalgamating the figure of Medea then with his own mother. Qui est cette femme dont je tombe? Who is this woman I fell out of? I'm sorry for the odd translation, I don't know. Nothing more is said here about Kinyarfer's relationship with his mother, but his sense of estrangement is contained in the demonstrative adjective cette. Kinyarfer's reading is followed by a moment of total darkness and silence. And then very progressively, as the koto player starts sounding his string instrument, which can loosely be compared with a cittern, Carlota Ikeda emerges progressively out of the darkness. She then starts what Kinyarfer calls her trance, a 40-minute improvisation made of slow torsions and tensions, spasmodic movements, controlled falls and extensions, crawling and raising movements, which appear at once as an expression of basic affect and a rediscovery of archaic movement. Much could be said about the light and dramaturgy of this performance, but in relation to the paper, I'll just highlight one of its most striking features, the fact that it both seems to represent a cathartic journey, a passage through the infernos, as well as a proletarian journey towards birth and life. So Ikeda's dance does not seem to attempt any narrative. With its slowness, it rather seems to the to the dancer's own body, present and capacity to move. This self-referential nature of the dance may at times be puzzling for the spectator, who is forced to question what is at stake in the very immediacy of dance as an art form. In L'Origine de la Danse, Quignard's account of his experience with Ikeda is for him the opportunity to meditate on Buteau and to extrapolate and give meaning to dance and movement more generally. What attracts Quignard to Buteau is that it is a dance to do with birth, rebirth and reconstruction. Medea is the infanticide mother who also represents civilization itself. Toute nation est une Médée, little boy, tel est le nom de la bombe que la mère, la société américaine, lâcha au-dessus de la population civile d'Hiroshima. So all nations are Medeas, little boy, that was the name of the bomb that the mother American society dropped on Hiroshima's civil population. Any nation loves to sacrifice its youngest children, its most beautiful children, when they reach adolescence, says Pascal Quignard. One understands better Quignard's special affinity with Ikeda, who was born in 1941 and grew up like him amidst the ruins of World War II. And also Quignard's special affinity with Buteau, which, according to his own glossing, at least, is a dance that belonged to those who seek to survive. Buteau, that's my other following quote, Buteau is the dog dance that propels the newborn who seek to move about and survive on the surface of the earth. It is a dance that attempts rebirth. It is life that seeks to be reborn through primal movement. For Quignard, Buteau imitates the prenatal dance of the fetus in the womb, its slow floating and crawling movements. In that, it is not so much regressive as it is a return to a prelapsarian state before birth. There are two dances, he says. The first precedes birth, that ends with birth. The second dance reproduces, transposes, recomposes, translates the best it can the lost state of swimming in the amniotic fluid before the helplessness of birth. So as it is fantasized as a return to a prenatal state, Buteau becomes an ideal for both dancing and writing should work towards. Beauty for Pascal Quignard is indeed linked to the helplessness of a newborn. He says, la beauté est liée à la maladresse de l'origine. Le premier pas que fait l'enfant est un pas qui trébuche, qui titube, et c'est le plus beau des pas qui puissent se trouver dans le monde sublunaire où survivent, comme ils peuvent, les fils des mortels. So beauty is linked to a primal awkwardness. The first step that the child takes is a faltering, stumbling step that is the most beautiful one to be found in a sublunar world where the sons of mortals survive the best they can. So for Quignard, dance and beauty has little to do with the sublimation of instinctual drives or the control of bodily techniques. L'art ne sublime pas, he says in another of his essays, Rhetorique Speculative. Art is no process of sublimation. Instead, it is an exercise of letting go and giving in to the body's own energy. And writing, like dance, should be an attempt to recapture it when it is lost in the very process of writing. In that respect, Quignard quite radically departs from the Romantic and Modernist tradition. If for both Mallarmé and Valéry, dance is an ideal of embodied writing, the body of the dancer, however, always points towards something beyond its own corporeality. For Mallarmé, dance is a form of bodily writing, superior insofar it suggests and speaks for itself when language cannot. Ultimately, la danseuse n'est pas une femme qui danse, he says. Likewise, in L'âme et la danse, Valéry's dancer is again an ideal, a metaphor, for an ideal metaphor, at once embodied, corporeal, and abstract. So if dance is a return to a prenatal state for Quignard, it is also a form of expression best suited to capture the residue of affect and primary emotions, like pain, joy, desire, anger, that articulated language can partly process and represent, yet never fully so. In that, Quignard's work enters in a resonance with the work of philosopher Jean-Luc Nancy, as both see dance as a form of trance. It is an exercise of self-oblivion, of relinquishing one's identity in order to better reconnect with the impersonality of one's body, the intensity of affect, and the physicality of it. In conclusion, I would like to come back to my initial question: how is dance construed as a consoling practice in L'Origine de la Danse? Médéa is a work of mourning, both personal and cultural. Quignard's recrimination against a mother who, in his experience, has not managed to love him or love him enough is all the more violent and intense for being obliquely expressed. The mourning is the mourning of a mother who was never present enough is folded into the myth of Médéa and a meditation on dance and humanity's capacity for self-destruction. Mourning, and melancholy mourning in particular, has been an obsessive theme in both Quignard's fiction and essays. Yet a shift seems to have occurred in L'Origine de la Danse, where mourning as a process of sense-making and giving meaning to loss seems to come to fruition. Le Havre, he says, Hiroshima, Fukushima, Tokyo, ces ports détruits se rejoignaient. Sur scène, dans l'obscurité, face à Carlota Ikeda, ma vie avait un sens. So, the translation. So, in front of Carlota Ikeda, suddenly my life made sense, he says. So the pas de deux, performed by Ikeda and Quignard, may well be for the author a renewed and this time successful attempt to enact a silent dialogue with an ambivalent maternal figure. And in that respect, it holds a cathartic function. But more generally, dance appears to be consoling as it is an attempt to reconnect and express bodily affect, pain and grief in particular, in ways articulated language does not allow. In that sense, dance accomplishes what the German Lied did for Roland Barthes, that is, jouir fantasmatiquement de mon corps unifié. It allows to enjoy the fantasy of a unified body. Whether it is singing or dancing, art is no process of sublimation for Quignard. But dance perhaps partakes in the sublime insofar as it offers a temporary reconciliation between what reason cannot encompass, the mind cannot fully comprehend, but yet what the body does experience. Thank you for your attention.
So I've got the paper. I just want to make two or three remarks before that actually begins. The first is that a handout's going round, which is very kindly been copied by Rosie. The other remarks are just really to say something about Le Coulabart, who you may or may not be familiar with. He was a friend and colleague of Derrida, but more importantly than that, he collaborated regularly with Jean-Luc Nancy. They lived together in a kind of experimental community. They wrote together and lectured together. So this is really a sort of common enterprise often when we're talking about Le Coulabart. Now this community was based in Strasbourg in the east of France, and as you know, it's an exemplary European city. You know, it's very much a shared heritage between France and Germany. So I've given previous papers on the two thinkers and their relationship to Europe, and hopefully in what I'm going to say today, some of the questions that are coming up this morning about whether Europe is whether European literature is hyper-national or whether it is comparative and therefore a reaction against the national might be coming through in what I'm going to say. So I'll now start the paper itself. Despite its apparently firm bases in historical reality, the distinction between ancients and moderns has proven adept at provoking controversy and debate. With the three figures mentioned in my title, for instance, the shortest of historical surveys, which show that Sophocles was an ancient and Hilderlin and Le Coulibart both moderns. However, things alter once we begin to apply greater pressure to these categories, and it will suggest that the distinction between ancient and modern can be found as an internal division within the work of each of these writers. Before then, however, it's worth recalling the justification for placing together these three figures and their three different contexts: the 5th century Greek Enlightenment, speculative and romantic thought, and deconstruction in the 1970s and 80s. The first connection is made by Hilderlin, who begins to translate Antigone and Oedipus Rex during his stay in Bordeaux. This location is not indifferent, given that it caused him to write that, and I quote, "The athleticism of people in the south, in the ruins of the ancient spirit, made me better acquainted with the true essence of the Greeks." In other words, he found Greece in Bordeaux, and from that moment began translating into German the two Sophocles plays, which were published in 1804, a year before he was pronounced clinically insane. The second connection is then made by Le Coulibart, who translated into French Hilderlin's German versions of Sophocles' plays, Antigone in 1979 and Oedipus Rex in 1998. Additionally, he worked on stage productions of the two texts, thus following in the wake of previous stagings of Sophocles and Hilderlin by Brecht, Antigone in 1948, and Heine Müller with Oedipus Rex in 1969. So Le Coulibart's approach is thus multifarious, drawing on translation, dramaturgy and stage production, as well as critical or philosophical commentary. Before coming to the latter for the main part of this paper, it would be a shame not to give at least the smallest glimpse of the other disciplines through which he responds to Sophocles and Hilderlin, and with them to the question of ancients and moderns. First, translation. The French thinker's declared approach is a literalist rather than a naturalising one. In this way, he seeks to reproduce the experience of translation as what has been called an épreuve de l'étranger, relating to Hilderlin's German in the same way as Hilderlin related to Sophocles' Greek. To take a single example, the German Begeisterung could be translated either as enthousiasme, based on the Greek theos, or as inspiration, based on the Latin spiritus. But Le Coulibart rejects both these equivalents and opts instead to translate Begeisterung as position par l'esprit, a solution that is awkward, even borderline unacceptable, insofar as it adds a new strangeness which is not present in the German, but it does serve his own philosophical aims. Sorry. As for his dramaturgical and staging work, we can note that it took place in radically different settings. The two productions of Antigone were held in abandoned warehouses in Strasbourg, whilst Oedipus Rex was shown in the Corps d'Honneur at the Avignon Festival. Again, few concessions are made to naturalisation or naturalism. A minimalist staging aimed to allow an emphasis on the interaction between the actors' bodies and their words. The approach was uncompromising and, in the eyes of some contemporary reviewers, unsuccessful. In any case, it's justified as follows by Le Coulibart. Theatre is a brutal, pitiless art. It allows of no approach. It is an immediate reckoning with truth, which is to say, with probity. To translate Hilderlin and Sophocles at the same time, to offer him to enunciation, to imagine the space and the gestures, to provide the props, to think about what one must cause to be thought, not to give in to beauty, nor, above all, to emotion, to be just. All of these require a courage about which not even teaching gives us an adequate idea. So something of Le Coulibart's motivation for working in a theatre can be seen here. We are at once outside philosophical discourse, any approach from an exterior position is ruled out, and by the same token, brought closer to what he calls thought. And this thought is to be found in the various confrontations and dialectics that tragic theatre provides us with. So let us now come on to how these confrontations feature in Le Coulibart's critical discussions. Both the object and the status of these discussions provide us with pause for thought. For to state that they address the various dialectics present in tragic theatre and address them in a philosophical way seems close to the truth, but due to this very closeness is in fact a statement that Le Coulibat would surely reject. Indeed, to a large extent, Hölderlin is chosen as an object of study because he thinks along similar lines to his student friends Schelling and Hegel, but ultimately does so in a less speculative or dialectical way. This can be seen when the French thinker plays on the terms marque, remarque and démarque, the latter meaning a marking down, as in a commercial sale. He asks, and I quote, "How is the démarque of the speculative in Hölderlin at the same time its marking or its remarking? How, in other words, is the speculative deconstituted? I mean, how is it unmade and deconstructed in the very movement whereby it is set up, installed, established as a system?" The German poet is therefore of interest because he's both inside and outside this speculative or dialectical system. He's the figure whereby its limits and limitations might be determined. In this context of a reading that resembles a dialectic without actually being one, Le Coulibat often uses the term antagonism. This he often brings into communication with the notion of agony, surely, however, falling into the trap of pathos or emotion that we saw him describing. But at other times, his interest lies in the more neutral root agon, meaning contest, competition, or struggle. And this is particularly suitable as a framework for his reading, given his view that, and I quote, "Tragedy is the site where what makes the essence of knowledge is revealed, as well as what animates the desire for knowledge, being faced with contradiction, and this in the most general terms." There are, of course, numerous ways of understanding contradiction within tragic theatre. These begin with the interaction between physical body and speech, as in much theatre, but also take in the thematised clashes between men and gods, and the formal division between characters on stage and the chorus in the orchestra, the circular dancing space. Hölderlin's friend Schelling wrote on the contradiction between destiny and liberty, arguing that although men are not free from prophecies and the gods in tragedy, the cruel and unusual punishments they receive can act as a spur for such freedom to be demanded. And for his part, Hegel paid great attention to the interaction between Creon and Antigone in Sophocles' play. But although each of these avenues could provide a way of exploring the nexus between Sophocles, Hölderlin, and Le Coulibat, I wish to explore the presence in unexpected and revealing places of the antagonism between ancient and modern. One of the unexpected places where this division falls, at least on the reading provided by Hölderlin and after him Le Coulibat, is within Sophocles' oeuvre. On this view, he is not the ancient object read, imitated, or relayed by modern subjects, but instead already performs this leap into subjectivity. Here we are in the vicinity of the old idea that modernity begins in Greece. The detail for this thesis is to be found in the reading whereby Hölderlin relates to Oedipus Rex and Antigone, not in the narrative order in which they feature in this series of Theban plays, where Antigone is the later play, recounting the death of its central figure, who after all is Oedipus's daughter. Instead, Hölderlin reverses this narrative order. Thus, Le Coulibat can describe the two plays as follows. And I quote, "The two Sophocles tragedies that Hölderlin took as ideally representative of the opposition, which constitutes history itself, between the ancient and the modern, or in his lexicon, between the Oriental and the Hesperian, Antigone and Oedipus Rex." The justification given for this reversal is that the lead protagonist in Antigone defines herself by ancient or archaic values. She defends Polynices' name, doing so because he is her brother, and thus an irreplaceable being in her life, given to her, as it were, before any rationalisation or decision of her own. And she defends his right to a decent burial, namely his right to return to the soil, an ultimate homeland more fundamental than the political order of the day. Beyond these factors, she compares her contested martyr state to that of a mythological figure, Niobe. And Hölderlin also adds to his version of the play an invocation to what she calls my Zeus, with underlining the my. In short, Antigone draws out and represents a coalition of relatively obscure, archaic and ancient forces. The same divisions or antagonisms are present in Oedipus Rex, but because the emphasis is placed contrary-wise, Hölderlin takes the play to be essentially modern, or at least evolving in the direction of modernity. Certainly, the action within the play shows a prophecy being given and then confirmed via what Freud interpreted as the driving force of obscure or ancient forces, the desire to kill one's father and marry one's mother. But within this formal constraint, a number of signs point in a different direction. For instance, La Coulibat draws on an interpretation of Oedipus's name different to the usual reference to his swollen feet. He relates the name to Oida, Greek for I have seen or I know, establishing the character as an active, questioning being. Secondly, the myth preceding the play tells of Oedipus killing the Sphinx, an obscure divine force, and doing so by solving the riddle with the answer mankind. He therefore ascends to the throne of Thebes thanks to this ingenuity, recognising human sameness amongst alterity, a speculative scenario if ever there was one. Third, whilst foretold by the prophecy, it's nonetheless by his acts that the crimes are committed. Fourthly, his downfall is provoked by his rationalising or totalising desire to find his father's murderer. La Coulibat glosses this downfall in the following terms, which set Oedipus up as an essentially modern figure. So I quote, "At the nadir of his final fury, Oedipus experiences only one thing, the withdrawal of the divine. The god now only manifests itself by suddenly ceasing to manifest itself, by which is meant by leaving mankind in a state of abandonment." This situation is of such importance for La Coulibat that he is driven to fuse new connections, beginning with it. For instance, he takes Oedipus to represent the French revolutionaries who were Hölderlin's contemporaries and influenced him on many counts. La Coulibat writes, "If Hölderlin made this choice of Antigone and Oedipus Rex, it seems to me that it is essentially due to modern political preoccupations. Oedipus, particularly, was a character who was resurfacing in history in the form of the dictator of reason. He was the French Revolution, Robespierre, Saint-Just, and then also Bonaparte." Far-fetched though this may seem, we can recall that Oedipus was king of Thebes, and what's more, one who replaced the Ancien Régime thanks to the use he makes of reason, a crucial element in revolutionary discourse. Beyond this, La Coulibat's description of him as a dictator of reason draws on the king's desire to find and punish Laius' murderer, itself surely a commendable aim, just as Creon's aims in Antigone can be painted as egalitarian and inspired by the rule of law. In any case, the appearance of Robespierre and Napoleon in La Coulibat's discussion of the two Sophocles plays translated by Hölderlin serves to confirm that a very lively antagonism between the ancient and the modern is a major issue. On this view, then, Sophocles cannot be taken entirely to be on the side of the ancients. And by the same token, we can ask what can be said about Hölderlin and La Coulibat and their relationship to modernity. So we've already suggested that Hölderlin's marginal position in relation to the speculative or dialectical thought of Schelling and Hegel establishes him as a figure not entirely aligned with the dominant modern interpretations of tragedy. And the same could be said for La Coulibat. Insofar as being a deconstructive thinker, his attention is given to ways in which overviews arrived at dialectically remain incomplete and always under suspension. Modernity's presence as a theme within the two Sophocles plays makes it easier for Hölderlin and La Coulibat to distance themselves from it. Oedipus in particular is seen as a figure of the modern, insofar as his desire for knowledge causes both his rise and fall. On their reading, this is exemplified by the reading I've already mentioned of his name as a modulation of Oida, I've seen or I know. And the motif of sight also provides the issue on which the two thinkers detach themselves from Oedipus. This is seen when La Coulibat states the following. "In accordance with the speculative interpretation of the name of Oedipus, but at a given distance from the philosophical heroization of him that speculative thought always performed, Hölderlin insists, in Greek style, on sight. It is the blind prophet Tiresias who comes to tell Oedipus the following blinding truth, that the very excess of your knowledge, your outrageous pursuit of the will to truth, demonstrates your besmirching and your downfall. Nothing other than the entire destiny of Western knowledge is at stake here. And this is full well what Hölderlin, the thought of caesura, brings into opposition, without opposition, obscurely, if you will, to Schelling and to Hegel. So this statement draws on Hölderlin's remarks on Oedipus, where he adopts a metrical metaphor representing Tiresias' intervention in the play as a caesura, or a counter-rhythmical interruption, in his words. As a blind prophet, Tiresias represents a resistance to the sight-based economy of modern knowledge and understanding, which is thematized within the play. He also features in Antigone, and again in his remarks on that play, Hölderlin prevents this intervention as an interruption in the metaphorical meter of the play. In this light, it's surely significant that Jean-Henri's famous, bleak, and modernized version of Antigone excludes the figure of Tiresias altogether. So such is the way that Hölderlin detaches himself from the modernity thematized within the two plays, and especially in Oedipus Rex. For his part, La Coulibat follows the German thinker extremely closely, down to the logic of what he calls opposition without opposition. We can read this formulation as a desire to question and contest dialectical approaches, but without doing so from any exterior, literally opposing standpoint, a standpoint which is posed or posited outside. In other words, he rejoins here the deconstructive principle of contesting a language or discourse without replacing it with any alternative. To simply replace the approaches to tragedy found in dialectical philosophy would merely fall back within their own logic. It's thus better to scan for moments of interruption or caesura when a breach in the dominant language opens up. Such is perhaps how we can articulate the interrelation of La Coulibat's translation and dramaturgical activities to the philosophy for which he is better known. They are not an alternative or a replacement, but instead breaches in the texture of critical philosophical discourse and its propensity for endless talk. Thank you.